This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents a Dark Star production. The Pucking Wrong Guy, Book 2 of the Pucking Wrong series, written by C.R. Jane. Performed by Troy Duran and Alexis Page.
I didn't hear him because my two Stanley Cup rings were plugging my ears.
Goalie Patrick Waugh.
Hockey Boyfriends Anonymous. Bunnies, hold on to your panties because this news is coming in hot. Hashtag sizzle. Mr. Tall, Dark, and Handsome, Ari Lancaster himself is no longer a Dallas Knight. Hashtag WTF. A shock considering he just won his first Stanley Cup with his longtime team. In a news conference held today, the LA Cobras announced they had successfully completed a trade for the star defenseman. Hashtag welcome to La La Land. I've put my head to the ground, bunnies, trying to figure out the reason, but so far I've got nothing. Tweet us if you hear any news. We have a feeling that whatever the reason is, it's going to be juicy.
Prologue. Before. Layla. My heart was a heavy stone in my chest as I walked hand in hand with my caseworker toward the looming group home. The gray sky mirrored my mood, and the air seemed colder than usual. It had been just a few weeks since I lost my parents, and the pain was still so fresh. It was an open wound that would never heal. I didn't see how it could. The building was old and intimidating, its tall brick walls casting a shadow over the entrance. I swallowed hard, gripping my teddy bear even tighter to my chest for comfort. I wished I could turn back, that this was all just a bad dream, that I could go home and my parents would be waiting there with open arms. My caseworker, Miss Thompson, squeezed my free hand gently. She had kind eyes and a warm smile, but they couldn't chase away the sadness that clung to me like a second skin. "It's gonna be okay, sweetie," she whispered, her voice soft and soothing. I nodded, even though I didn't really believe her. I was here because there was no one who wanted me. She could say otherwise, try to be positive and comforting about all this, but that was the truth. I was alone. I had no one. As we stepped inside, the hallway seemed to stretch forever in both directions. The walls were a dull beige, and the fluorescent lights overhead buzzed like angry bees. It smelled kind of musty, like old paper and cleaning supplies. The place didn't feel very welcoming. Miss Thompson led me toward a door at the end of the hallway, her footsteps echoing in the silence. We entered a small office where a stern-looking woman sat behind a desk cluttered with papers. She had gray hair pulled back into a tight bun and her glasses perched on the edge of her nose. "Ah, Miss Thompson," the woman said, her voice brisk. "This must be our new arrival." She glanced at me, her eyes briefly softening before pressing back into a tight line. Her sharp eyes bored into mine with an intensity that sent chills through my body. "Yes," Miss Thompson replied, her tone respectful. "This is Layla." I shifted nervously from foot to foot, clutching my teddy bear even tighter. I wished Mom and Dad were here. They always knew how to make me feel safe. The woman and Miss Thompson exchanged a few whispered words that I couldn't quite catch. My heart raced as I strained to listen, feeling like they were talking about something important. "I heard about her parents," the woman said, her voice low. "Such a tragedy." "Yes, this one is definitely a more difficult case," Miss Thompson replied, her voice filled with sympathy. "Have they figured out why he killed her?" I felt a lump forming in my throat, and I stopped trying to listen. They were talking about Mom and Dad. My eyes welled up with tears and I tried to blink them away. I didn't want the women to see me cry. I also didn't want to think about Mom and Dad like that. After a few more whispers, the woman smoothed her gray hair back, even though there wasn't a strand out of place in her severe bun. She stood and walked over to me before crouching to my level, her expression softening a little. "Hello, Layla," she said kindly. "My name is Mrs. Anderson. We're here to help you, okay?" I nodded, my voice caught in my throat. "Let's get you settled in." Mrs. Anderson held out a hand for me, and I instinctively grabbed it. It was cold and bony, nothing like my mom's hand. None of the strangers I'd been passed to since the police found me in our house had felt like Mom, though. Mrs. Anderson didn't waste any time, leading me out of the office and down another hallway. As I followed her, I wiped away a tear that had escaped, almost dropping my bear in the process. The hallway we walked down was lonely feeling, each step echoing like a heartbeat in the stillness. Mrs. Anderson's footsteps were steady beside me, only a slightly reassuring presence as I ventured further into the unknown. The walls were lined with old photographs of children who had lived here before, their smiles frozen in time. I wondered where they were now. Had they ever been happy? We arrived at a door that Mrs. Anderson pushed open with a gentle creak. The room inside was small and simple and cold. There were two beds with neatly made quilts, a desk with a chair, and a shelf with a few books. Dim light filtered through the curtains, casting a gray-tinged glow over everything. "This will be your room, Layla," Mrs. Anderson said, her voice kind. "You'll be sharing it with Michelle. I'm sure she'll be by soon, and you guys can get to know each other. Feel free to do whatever you want to make it your own." Staring around, it didn't seem like Michelle had done anything to make it her own. My stomach trembled with even more nerves. I looked around, feeling grief. It wasn't my old room back at home, filled with familiar posters and the lingering scent of Mom's cooking. I knew I should be grateful to be here since no one else had wanted me, but everything was wrong. The walls weren't painted a soft shade of lavender. Pictures of our little family's adventures all over. The bed wasn't overflowing with stuffed animals, and there weren't flowers on the nightstand like the ones Dad had brought me every week along with the ones he got Mom. "Thank you," I whispered, a wobble in my words. "You're welcome, dear," Mrs. Anderson replied with a soft smile as she ignored the pain in my voice. "If you need anything, don't hesitate to ask. I'll send someone to give you a tour in a little while. Dinner will be at 6 in the main room." I nodded, still struggling to find my words. She left me alone in the room, closing the door behind her. As I sat on the edge of the bed, my teddy bear clutched to my chest, a sense of loneliness washed over me. The tears I had held back earlier now streamed uncontrollably down my cheeks. The more minutes that ticked by, the more my emotions swirled like a tempest, a violent storm I couldn't control. The pain of loss, the raw loneliness, it all crashed over me like a relentless wave, tearing through the fragile dam of my composure. I felt like I was drowning in an ocean of tears, each sob an echo of the ache buried deep within me. Panic clawed in my chest, a vicious beast threatening to break free. The room, this alien space, seemed to constrict around me, a straitjacket of unfamiliarity that I couldn't escape. My heart raced, breaths coming in shallow gasps. I was teetering on the edge of an abyss. The world spun, a dizzying dance that left me disoriented and struggling to find my footing. Enough, I couldn't stay here. With a desperate gasp, I lurched off the bed, my vision a blur of salt water, my teddy bear falling from my hands. I sprinted down the corridor, a mad dash to outrun the encroaching panic. I burst from the building and into the field behind the orphanage, the cool breeze on my face a sharp contrast to the turmoil inside. I collapsed onto the grass, panic tightening its grip. It was as if the world had shattered and I was lost in the debris. Then, from out of the chaos, a voice sliced through.
"Hey, hey, it's okay. Just focus on your breath. I'm right here."
I blinked through tear-soaked lashes and saw a boy standing there, concern shining from his eyes. He looked at me as though he really saw me. There was no pity like there had been in the eyes of the officers, of everyone. His deep green gaze was absent of the resignation that Miss Thompson and Mrs. Anderson directed my way. No, all I saw in the depths of his stare was that he cared. His presence was like a lifeline in the storm, grounding me in the midst of my panic. His eyes were gentle, his voice soothing as he spoke.
"Deep breath, Angel. And then exhale, slowly. You're doing great."
The panic began to ebb away, replaced by a sense of calm that I hadn't thought possible. For a minute, the frenzy was gone. The world around me disappeared until nothing but silence was left. As the panic receded, I wiped away the remnants of my tears and peered up at him, a mix of gratitude and curiosity in my gaze. The boy looked a little older than me, his hair a storm of wild black waves that seemed to have a mind of its own. His vibrant green eyes sparkled with mischief, and something about them made my heart race. There was a smudge of dirt on his cheek, and his grin was wide, like he knew a million secrets and couldn't wait to share all of them. His lips curved up with a natural feeling of confidence that I'd never seen in someone. He stood there like he owned the world, his posture relaxed and ready for anything. "Thank you," I finally managed to rasp out when I realized I was just staring at him. His smile grew broader, like there was sunshine inside him he couldn't contain.
"It's no biggie."
His gaze darted over my face, and I wiped at the tears still dripping down my cheeks.
"I'm Ari, by the way."
My voice wavered as I replied, "Layla."
"Layla,"
he repeated, holding out his hand to help me off the ground. I stared at it for a long minute, not understanding why taking it seemed like such a big decision. When I finally reached out and grabbed it, my fate was sealed. I just didn't know it yet. Chapter 1. Layla, Crossoff, Blake.
"You got the fucking job!"
Kelsey screamed into the phone, making me wince as I pulled it away from my ear so I didn't lose all my hearing. Waldo growled at the sound, lifting his head from the floor where he'd been napping in the sun streaming in from the window. It took a second for what she'd said to sink in.
"I got it?"
I whispered, my fingers trembling as I touched my mouth in disbelief. Waldo's front paws landed on my leg and he started whimpering, obviously sensing the tension suddenly coursing across my skin.
"LA, baby!"
She was screaming again. But this time, the noise didn't even touch me. Because the long shot, life-changing thing I'd been trying not to think about, trying not to hope for, was finally coming true. Clark's face flashed through my mind. I hadn't even told him about it because I didn't want to risk a fight about something that wasn't going to happen. But now here it was, and speak of the devil, my phone buzzed, signaling an incoming call. "Clark. I've got to take this," I told her, cutting off whatever else my agent was about to say as I switched over.
"Hi,"
I squeaked out in an overly excited voice.
"Hey, baby, ready for tonight?"
he asked warmly. My stomach churned just thinking about the party I was supposed to attend with him later that evening. All those eyes. My gaze darted to the mirror on the wall, tracing the lines of my body in the reflection, noting all the imperfections, all the things they'd all see, all the things they'd think about me. I studied the neat line of scars on my hip and swallowed my anxiety down.
"Yep, 7, right?"
"Yes,"
he answered.
"I sent a dress for you. Can't wait to see you in it."
"Perfect," I whispered softly, squeezing my eyes shut as if it could take away the hot shame licking at my insides as I thought about how I'd look in that dress.
"I've got to jump into a meeting. I love you,"
he murmured in a voice that should have given me butterflies. "Goodbye," I whispered as the phone clicked, staring out the window of the tiny studio apartment I could barely afford. Clark knew it too. He'd been asking me to move in with him for 3 months, but I always had an excuse. How long until he got tired of my excuses? And then I was all alone. I'd be all alone in LA, though. Waldo barked as if he was offended by my thoughts. I knelt down and buried my face against his soft black and white fur. "I'm not alone, am I, boy?" I cooed, a smile peeking at my lips as he lathered kisses all over my face. I stayed like that for a moment, soaking in the warmth of him before I stood up and glanced around the room. My cramped studio apartment was a chaotic disaster, the exact opposite of the life I'd been forced to live after I'd been adopted. From the moment you walked through the door, it felt like you were diving into a whirlwind of colors, patterns, and creative clutter that would probably make no sense to anyone but me. Every inch of the small space was crammed with objects that spoke to my eclectic personality. The futon against the far wall functioned as both seating and my bed. Its cushions were worn, but I thought they still looked inviting, an assortment of throw pillows creating a nest where I often lost myself in books or daydreams. Against another wall, a vintage record player stood proudly, surrounded by stacks of vinyl records collected from thrift stores and flea markets. An old wooden coffee table, adorned with paint splatters from impromptu art sessions, acted as the centerpiece of my living space. The kitchen area was compact, containing nothing more than a tiny stove, barely large enough to fit a single pot, and a rusted old sink and mini fridge. Pots and pans were stacked precariously on open shelves, alongside an assortment of mismatched mugs and plates. In one corner, a distressed bookshelf groaned under the weight of my extensive book collection. It was my personal library, filled with dog-eared pages and highlighted passages that had impacted my soul in one way or another. There wasn't a closet in here, so my clothes hung from a clothing rack. Piles of shoes were tucked away in the corners, each pair scrounged up from my favorite thrift store. Clark hated this place. He hated the color and how much stuff there was. He couldn't understand that all I'd had when I'd gotten to that orphanage was a teddy bear. He couldn't understand the need I had to surround myself with things that were mine. My adoptive parents didn't understand either. They'd offered to pay for a penthouse and been disappointed when I'd refused, wanting to try and make it on my own. No one understood. "One step at a time, Blake," I murmured to myself, pushing my dark thoughts away and striding towards the bathroom to grab the anxiety pills waiting for me before I started getting ready for tonight. I took a deep breath in the elevator, cold dread sliding down my skin as the floors beeped by. The fabric of my dress whispered against me, elegance that I never quite got used to. The gown Clark had sent was a work of art, a masterpiece of pale pink satin and lace that flowed around me like a dream. Its beauty was a reminder of the life I'd been thrust into, one of glamour and perfection that I never lived up to. My adopted mother had expected refinement, and the fashion world had only reinforced it. Tonight, like so many other nights, it felt like I was wearing a costume, one that didn't quite fit. I should be used to it. I felt like that from the moment the Sheffields picked me up from that group home, changed my name, my identity, my world. Perfection was the decree in that cold mansion they'd taken me to, woven into every corner like a delicate but unyielding thread. The only imperfection allowed was that Mara Sheffield couldn't have children, hence the need for me. From the moment I entered that world, her impossible standards enveloped me, shaping my existence into a mosaic of precise expectation that went against everything my mom and dad had taught me. I was stuck in an intricate web spun from her vision of what life should be. Mara Sheffield was the definition of opulence, with a fevered taste for the finest things that life had to offer. She projected this onto me like a mirror image. The clothes I wore were always meticulously chosen. Every occasion, no matter how casual, demanded an aura of perfection that felt like armor I had to constantly wear. It wasn't just about the clothes, though. It was about the posture, the way I spoke, the way I held my fork during meals. She trained me to glide through life as if every step was choreographed, as if every word was scripted. My appearance and behavior were meant to be a canvas that reflected her, and any deviation from her expectations was met with sharp disappointment that cut deep into my skin. In her world, even a speck of imperfection was a stain that tarnished the glossy veneer she worked so tirelessly to maintain. She believed that life was a performance, a grand stage where we were all actors in an elaborate play, and her role, it seemed, was that of the director, guiding every scene with precision and determination. Her insistence on perfection had been a heavy weight on my shoulders since that first day they'd picked me up, a burden that left little room for me to breathe, to stumble, to exist. And amidst the glamour, the designer dresses, and the extravagant events, I often found myself wondering if there was a place for me. At the bottom of the stairs, I glanced towards the waiting car, a bitter ache settling in my chest that I refused to examine closely. Clark was standing outside the car waiting for me, a phone to his ear, his gaze dancing across me admiringly. I tried to return the grin, but I didn't have it in me. What did he see when he looked at me? Because I was sure he didn't see the real me. He was his usual picture of beautiful sophistication. The only thing out of place was his black hair, which fell in calculated disarray over his forehead. He'd once told me he styled it that way because it made him look more personable. Turns out, he also thought everything was a performance. His vibrant green eyes stared at me with the same interest they'd had since the first night when we'd met. I couldn't find fault with him about that. I'd seen him with his friends, though. Times when I'd gone to the bathroom and hovered in the hallway like a creep as I watched him smile and shine with them. It wasn't the same smile and shine as when we were alone. He smiled at me like a burden. Or maybe that was my imagination. I never could be too sure these days. Or maybe that was just my crazy talking. Because as Miss Shupfield always said, only a fool wouldn't want Clark. Dressed in a perfectly tailored tuxedo, the suit seemed to mold to his form as if it were a second skin. There was a tension in his posture right then. A subtle restlessness there that told me whoever was on the call was not doing what he wanted. And Clark always got what he wanted. Even me. He slid his palm down my back and waited for me to slide into the limo before following behind. As the car glided along the city streets, I watched him discreetly, conflicting emotions churning within me. There was a time when his presence was a sanctuary for me, when I thought he was my hero, helping me escape the weight of the Shepfield's demands. But now, in the confines of that car? I opened my mouth several times to tell him about the life-changing news I'd received that morning, but I couldn't quite get the words out. The car pulled up outside the Metropolitan Museum then, breaking me out of my gloomy thoughts, and its grandeur loomed before us. Clark ended his call, and his attention shifted to me, his gaze meeting mine.
"We're here, sweetheart,"
he murmured as if I hadn't noticed, reaching up to brush his fingers across my cheek. His tone was gentle, but it still served as a reminder that tonight held a weight beyond the glittering surface of the gala. His business partners and all the who's who of the city would be there, another night of pretending to be something I wasn't. His eyes lingered over me, and his gaze intensified, as if he were taking in every detail, every nuance of my appearance. I felt a rush of vulnerability under that scrutiny, my insecurities threatening to bubble to the surface.
"Most beautiful girl I've ever seen,"
he finally said when his inspection was complete. But I didn't feel the words like I should have. His driver, Ryan, opened the door, and Clark's mask slipped on, that gorgeous smile of his there for everyone to see, backlit by the camera flashes of the paparazzi who stalked these events. He extended his hand to help me out. His touch was warm, his demeanor exuding confidence and charm as he guided me onto the steps of the museum. We stepped into the horde of flashing lights and the chorus of society photographers calling our names. Clark moved me this way and that, making sure they got all our best angles. It was a dance we'd perfected, a game of smiles and posed elegance that masked the real emotions lurking beneath. I plastered on a smile, my gaze fixed on Clark like he was everything as he expertly navigated the spectacle. The cameras captured our every move, the bright flashes turning the night into a whirlwind of frozen moments. With each click of the camera, I felt a wave of pressure, the weight of expectation crashing over me. And as Clark led me inside the museum, his arm tightly around me like he knew I wanted to bolt, I felt like I was going to be sick. Inside, the museum had undergone a remarkable metamorphosis, shedding its usual air of quiet reverence for an opulent transformation. Mara had outdone herself. The entrance staircase bloomed with cascading flowers and flowing drapes of purple and cream, like a grand portal into a realm of extravagance. The atrium had become an ethereal ballroom, aglow with the radiance of crystal chandeliers that dripped from the ceiling like suspended stardust. The velvet curtain-lined corridors whispered with the melodies of live music, inviting guests to twirl and converse amidst the echoes of artistry. The museum's scholarly skin was gone, in its place a living, breathing masterpiece of elegance.
We mingled with the crowd, or should I say, Clark mingled with the crowd. I stood there, kind of like an accessory. Clark's hand rested lightly on my back the entire time, his conversations a drudgery of smooth fake words. He was a master of this world, and I was not. I grimaced when I heard a familiar tinkling laugh. Mara. I didn't call them Mom and Dad behind closed doors. That was only in public. Her laugh was somehow a mixture of refinement and superiority, and it always made me cringe inwardly. Taking a deep breath, I waited for her to approach, dread dripping down my spine like a bead of sweat. And then there they were, Thomas and Mara Shepfield. Mara's appearance was as polished as ever, a vision of refined beauty that drew eyes to her like a siren song. Just looking at her, she could be anywhere between her 20s and 40s, not a line marring her face. Her blonde hair was perfectly coiffed, every strand carefully placed. Her black gown, the epitome of couture, clinging to her figure in all the right places. I actually resembled her. I'd overheard them discussing it one night, how that was one of the reasons they'd picked me instead of a baby. Because anyone meeting them would assume I was really theirs. Lucky me. Thomas, standing beside her, was the embodiment of classic charm. His tailored tuxedo exuded an air of effortlessness, his silver-streaked hair adding a touch of distinguished elegance. His eyes held a warmth that offered a stark contrast to Mara's demeanor, a warmth that I knew, however, didn't go skin deep. As they approached Clark and me, Mara's eyes scanned my body with a scrutinizing gaze that only made the dread clawing at my insides thicken. With a calculated smile, she said, "Blake, I see you didn't use the makeup and hair team I suggested." Her words were laced with subtle venom, and the comment, which would sound pretty innocuous to anyone listening around us, hit me like a brick to the face, the pain a stark contrast to the facade of smiles and laughter around us. "It's good to see you too, Mother," I replied coolly as Clark brushed his fingers down my back soothingly. She and Thomas cooed over Clark, and he spat back some equally idiotic pleasantries. I could normally force myself to listen to them for however long I needed to, but tonight, the sound of their voices was like ants burrowing into my skin. "I'll be right back," I murmured, pulling away from Clark's hand with a strained smile, ignoring the shock and dismay all over Mara's face over my rudeness. I turned a head toward the bathroom. I just needed a minute to gather my thoughts and mend the cracks that threatened to widen within me. I could feel their gazes piercing into me, and that ever-present feeling grew. The one that said I'd never be good enough. For anybody. The bathroom was somehow blissfully empty when I walked in, and I stood in front of the mirror, taking a few deep breaths, trying to get a hold of myself. Trying to keep all that emotion thrashing around inside me firmly locked in my chest. I stared at my reflection in the gilded mirror, my gaze filled with self-loathing. I was a model. The world called me beautiful. And I hated everything about myself. Blonde waves framed my face, a cascade of hair that others might admire, but all I saw were imperfections, strands that never seemed to fall just right, a perpetual messiness that clashed with what everyone wanted from me. My dark blue eyes stared back, their hue an exotic anomaly that was almost violet, yet all I could think about were the dark circles that blemished the skin beneath them, a reminder of sleepless nights and anxious days. And then there were my lips, oversized, drawing attention I didn't want. I despised the way they looked when I smiled, as if they were shouting for attention, betraying my discomfort with the mask I wore. My reflection seemed to taunt me, every detail an assault on the confidence I struggled to hold on to. When I stared at my body, I saw bulges and angles that seemed to amplify my flaws. The neckline that was supposed to exude allure only made me feel exposed. My bare skin, a testament to my vulnerability. I pinched at the fabric near my waist, the critical thoughts in my mind forming a symphony of self-doubt. Everything felt wrong. My hair, my eyes, my lips, my body. Each aspect of my appearance a gateway for relentless scrutiny. No matter how hard I tried,
I couldn't silence the chorus of negativity that echoed within me. The bathroom door swung open then, and Michelle, my best frenemy, sauntered in with an air of all the confidence that I lacked. Her dark brown hair cascaded in sleek waves around her shoulders. Her doe-like brown eyes held a glint of mischief, and her lips were adorned with a bold shade of red lipstick. Her figure-hugging black dress clung to her curves perfectly, a daring slit revealing just enough to leave an impression. She moved with a grace that was both captivating and enigmatic, an embodiment of self-assuredness that had always drawn people to her. "Blake," Michelle greeted, her voice carrying a blend of warmth and sarcasm that only she could manage. I glanced up from the mirror, meeting her gaze with apprehension. "Hey, Michelle." She leaned against the counter, her eyes scanning me with a hint of amusement. "Oh, wow, Blake, you look different." I sighed at her comment because it was par for the course with her, trying to ignore how her words were a direct hit to my already fragile state. "That's nice to hear," I said sarcastically. "You couldn't show weakness with Michelle. She was like a shark constantly on the hunt for blood. And I'd been her favorite target since our days at the orphanage. She'd been adopted by one of the Sheffield friends, and I'd been stuck with her for better or for worse." Her red lips curled into a sly smile, her gaze never leaving my face. "Well, I've never seen you wear so much makeup before. It's like you're trying really hard tonight." Her words stung like a slap, sending me further down the spiraling path I'd already been on. I glanced away, unable to meet her gaze as the knot of humiliation tightened in my chest. "And that dress," Michelle continued, her tone light. "Did they send the wrong size?" I clenched my fists, my nails digging into my palms as I struggled to contain my rising anger. "You look gorgeous as well, Michelle," I drawled, stepping away from the mirror and moving past her. She shrugged casually, her gaze shifting to her perfectly manicured nails. "Don't be like that. I'm just speaking what everyone's thinking, Blake. You need that in a friend." Taking a deep breath, I finally met her eyes, a mix of hurt and frustration simmering beneath the surface that I did my best to hide. "Right." Michelle's gaze was triumphant as she watched me. She knew every button to press, every insecurity to pull at, and she was great at doing both. I turned away from her, but my reflection in the mirror seemed to support everything she'd just said. Michelle moved on from me and started chatting about the event, her voice a distant echo in my ears. She didn't even notice when I walked away, doing my best to lock up the weakness, determined to hold my head high and face the gala once more. Clark lifted an eyebrow when I reappeared in the crowd, silently asking me if I was okay. I nodded, letting him take my elbow and lead me to our table in the center of the room, a seating arrangement that couldn't be more suffocating. The table was set with pristine white linens and glittering crystalware. Plates adorned with meticulously arranged delicacies were presented like works of art as soon as we sat. The soft glow of candlelight danced across the faces of the attendees, casting an enchanting spell over the proceedings. I'm sure the food would taste delicious, if I allowed myself to actually enjoy it, which I would not. I'd never hear the end of it from Mara. As the courses were served, Mara took the stage for her keynote address. "Ladies and gentlemen, esteemed guests." Her voice carried through the air, laced with practiced grace. "Tonight we gather under this roof not only to celebrate our friendship, but to channel our resources and collective power toward a cause that holds a place in all our hearts, supporting underprivileged children. Every child, regardless of their background, deserves a fair chance at a brighter future," she continued, her tone softening for dramatic effect. "Our commitment to their upliftment isn't just an act of philanthropy. It's a testament to the empathy that binds us together as a community." I watched from my seat, my gaze tracing the gestures and expressions that accompanied Mara's words. She spoke with an air of sincerity, each phrase a carefully crafted thread woven into the tapestry of her performance. But inwardly, my eyes rolled with every platitude,
every rehearsed sentiment that danced on the surface of her speech.
As we indulge in the splendor of this evening, let us not forget the faces of those who will benefit from our generosity.
Mara continued, her voice taking on a note of heightened emotion.
The children who dream, who aspire, and who deserve a chance to break free from the chains of circumstance.
My mind wandered, my thoughts a whirlwind of cynicism as I listened to the flowery language that disguised the hollow reality.
It was all fake.
Mara could care less about underprivileged children. I'd seen her fire household staff for getting pregnant. And I'd never forget her pouring her iced coffee on a small boy who asked for some money in Central Park.
Mara droned on, and when she was finished, applause erupted like a wave, the attendees drawn willingly into the illusion she wove.
As the applause echoed, Clark suddenly rose from his seat, a shimmering glass in hand. He tapped the glass, the clear sound slicing through the hum of conversation like a clarion call. I frowned. It wasn't like him to perform public toasts. He considered that beneath him.
Ladies and gentlemen,
he began, his voice carrying a confidence that held the room captive.
Tonight is more than just a celebration of a noble cause. It's a celebration of something far more personal, something that has changed my life in ways I never anticipated.
I sat there, frozen in shock. My breath caught in my chest as Clark's voice wove anticipation around us. My gaze remained locked on him, my mind racing to comprehend what he was saying. He turned towards me, all the warmth his eyes usually lacked, suddenly there.
Blake, from the moment we met, my life took a turn I could have never predicted. You showed me a world that mattered. A world I never would have discovered without you. You've been my foundation, my confidant, and my muse.
My heart raced, the gravity of his words sending shockwaves through my being. The room seemed to blur, my focus narrowing to Clark's figure standing before me.
And so,
his voice trembled slightly, a rawness there that made my insides ache.
I can't imagine a more perfect moment to ask you the most important question of my life.
He sank to one knee, a box materializing in his hand as he held it out. My breath caught, my mind struggling to process what was unfolding before me. The world seemed to spin, the implications of his actions colliding with my inner turmoil.
Will you marry me?
I stared at him kneeling there, and for a moment, I was tempted to say yes. It would be so much easier. But then my thoughts drifted, unbidden to the life he was asking me to accept. Maybe he would love me. Maybe he'd even do his best to make me happy. But this life would only lead to loneliness masked by grandeur. I would crumble under the weight of it. I'd have a fake smile plastered on my lips forever. And I'd never stop being lonely. I'd never stop yearning for something more. My fingers clenched at the sight of the ring. I knew the cold metal of it would feel like an anchor dragging me into a sea of despair. I'm sorry. The words escaped my lips in a whisper, my voice tinged with sorrow, because he really was such a good man, and I was the fool who couldn't take what he was offering.
What?
Clark's expression shifted from confident anticipation to shock. I hadn't known I would say no before this moment. I never would have guessed it, in fact. But I steadied myself, meeting his gaze with a mixture of resolve and pain. I can't marry you. The words hung in the air, a declaration that shattered the spell that had enveloped the room. Gasps and whispers erupted around us, the shock of my rejection echoing like a thunderclap. Without another word, I pushed away from the table, my steps urgent as I fled the room. The clatter of my heels against the marble floor was a rhythm to my escape, a desperate sprint toward the freedom that awaited outside those lavish walls.
The gala's grandeur was reduced to a blur as I burst through the doors. The cool night air, a welcome contrast to the suffocation that had gripped me. With every step, the weight of my decision grew lighter, the whispers of the gala fading into the distance as I embraced the possibility of a different future, one where happiness was a possibility.
Chapter 2. Ari. California. I grimaced at the sunshine inside for the millionth time since my plane had touched down. I was standing in the parking lot of the arena, just staring at the building. Practice started in 30 minutes, and I had a bunch of bullshit I needed to do before I stepped onto the ice. Instead, I decided to procrastinate a little bit longer and call my good old buddy Lincoln. "That's the land of milk and honey," Lincoln drawled as soon as he picked up. "Ugh, you sound way too smug and self-satisfied. You just had sex." "Yep," he said with all the happiness of an asshole who was being laid regularly by his soulmate. "Huh, tell my bestie I say hi," I snorted. He scoffed. "She's not your bestie," he immediately shot back. "Monroe only has one best friend, and that's me." I cackled because he had the same reaction every time we had this conversation, and it was making me feel better. "You're standing in the parking lot, aren't you?" he said. "Yep. Just getting pumped to see Soto." "Yep." There was silence for a moment. "This season is going to be weird." I swallowed, because now wasn't the time to get all emotional about the fact that I'd given up my dream life to spend a year in California. To get my dream girl. Okay, it was worth it. "I'm going to go piss off Soto," I said, rather than answering because I needed to hold on to my mantra that big girls don't cry and all of that. "Knock 'em dead. 1 year," I said. "1 year," he answered. And then the phone clicked off. Now that I'd gotten that dreamy motivational speech, it was time to go in. I started towards the colossal structure before me because LA obviously had to overcompensate for things. Its architecture was sleek and pragmatic, tall columns framing the entrance, reflecting the sunshine and the pulsating energy around. The oversized windows, branded with the team's insignia, gave me a sneak peek of what was inside. A sea of blue seats, the pristine ice waiting for skates, and the anticipation that only a roaring crowd could generate. In that moment, I could almost hear the distant cheers, the sound of blades cutting through the ice, and the satisfying thump of a puck connecting with its mark. I took a deep breath, the salt-tinged air mingling with the distant hum of the city. And for the first time, my fingers tingled with anticipation. "Let's go, boys." I ambled into the Cobra's locker room, the colors assaulting my eyeballs like a fashion disaster at a circus. Seriously, who decided that purple and yellow were the ultimate power combo? My inner fashion critic went on strike right then and there. But I had to begrudgingly admit the place wasn't a dump. The lockers shone like they were auditioning for a toothpaste commercial, and the gear was so neatly arranged, one of the employees had to have a raging case of OCD. As some enthusiastic voice from the front office droned on next to me about team history, my mind decided it was a great time for a mini vacation. My feet, however, were on a mission of their own, leading me down the locker-lined path like they knew something I didn't. Maybe they thought there was a hidden treasure chest of snacks at the end of the line of jerseys. I caught bits of the presenter's spiel about team dynamics and the upcoming season. Yeah, synergy, chemistry, blah, blah. My brain was pondering more important matters like how in the world I'd ended up in this fucking locker room. But there I was, surrounded by the scent of sweaty balls and Lysol. There he fucking was. When I turned the corner, John Soto was leaning against one of the lockers, my rival extraordinaire, or as I like to call him, the poster child for bad hair dye. Looking like a mole on someone's left ass cheek. Not my left ass cheek, obviously. There was only perfection there. But someone's. Do you need anything before practice, Mr. Lancaster? The office minion finished his spiel, staring at me hopefully like he was going to get a tip after one of the more boring experiences of my adult life. Maybe he'd accept a stick of gum. That had worked for Kevin McAllister, after all.
Nice of you to grace us with your presence, Lancaster,
Soto drawled then, yanking my attention away from bubblegum tips to his ugly face. The trade had just happened, so I'd missed most of preseason training. But fuck my life. Hopefully Layla knew how to make cookies, because I would deserve several panfuls after my sacrifice this year. Blake, not Layla. I needed to remember that was her name now. Soto chuckled, temporarily pulling my thoughts away from my soulmate. I shivered in mock disgust as I stared at him. Reddish hair that could probably be seen from space. A nose that seemed to have been designed by Picasso during his abstract phase, and eyes that were more watery green than a kiddie pool at a summer camp. Soto was a walking masterpiece of genetic mishaps. It was like the universe decided to throw all the quirky features it had in storage and mash them together into a character that even a caricature artist would hesitate to sketch. Other members of the team were watching us, and I gave them a little salute. Because I was classy like that.
Hell must have iced over, boys. Ari Lancaster is in the house,
Soto droned. Soto's voice, I swear, was like a high-pitched car alarm that got stuck on repeat. You know those cartoons where a character inhales helium and starts talking like they're auditioning for a chipmunk choir? Well, Soto must have had bad helium for breakfast, because his voice would have made those chipmunks weep.
Someone had to class you up, boys,
I drawled, surveying the team, mentally cataloging what I knew about them from playing against them the last few years. First up was Callum, the human wall they called a defenseman. I had to hand it to him, the guy had a wingspan that could probably block out the sun. His nickname could have been No Entry Zone with those arms. But for all his defensive prowess, he moved like a glacier in the Sahara. Give that guy a GPS tracker because he could use some directions on the ice. He'd be relegated to second line now that I was here. But he wasn't glaring at me, so props to him. Then there was Tommy, the sniper with a shot that could probably take down satellites. His accuracy was like a heat-seeking missile, and he had the kind of poker face that would make Lady Gaga proud. But get him into a fight, and he turned into a deer caught in headlights. I guess body checks weren't part of his playlist. And let's not forget Frankie, the speed demon on skates. Seriously, if he went any faster, he might turn into a blur and disappear into another dimension. The guy was like a caffeine-fueled cheetah, darting around the ice like he was late for a date with destiny. But his focus sometimes took a vacation mid-game. I swear he'd be zipping along one moment and then suddenly doing the ice equivalent of interpretive dance the next. My gaze flicked back to Soto. He had no strengths, only weaknesses. And I didn't want to hurt my pretty brain going over them. L.A. didn't suck, but they were nothing like my boys in Dallas. 1 year. Soto sighed and held out his hand to me.
Truce,
he suddenly offered, and honestly, keeping the laughter in was all I could do because never would that happen. I acted like I was considering it and started extending my hand before abruptly yanking it back. Sorry, Soto. I can't even pretend to like you. Soto's face curled up in a snarl as he dropped his fake-ass peace offering.
Fuck you, Lancaster.
I winked at him. Sorry, not without dinner first. Your tiny dick would be so forgettable I'd have to at least get a steak out of it. The locker room erupted in laughter, and I was impressed. Maybe these guys had a sense of humor after all. I strolled to the locker with my name on it so I could get ready for practice, pleased with how the day was going. I could feel his gaze on my back, like he was trying to shoot lasers into my butt cheeks.
Walker Davis, a voice next to me said as I pulled my skates out of the bag I'd brought with me.
I glanced over. Ah, Walker. The team's resident heartthrob. Before my arrival, of course. And all-American poster boy. If life were a rom-com, he'd be cast as the dashing lead who effortlessly steals hearts and has a smile that features in 40 billion Instagram pages. Brown hair that probably had its own fan club.
the kind of jawline that made sculptors reconsider their life choices, and eyes that sparkled like they were in a perpetual photo shoot. Walker was the embodiment of every high school crush come to life. I wouldn't be surprised if he woke up every morning to a choir of birds helping him get dressed. Get him in a room with Lincoln and me, and people would be fainting all over the place. He was also the only all-star on the team before today, his skills actually surpassing my boy Bender. He was a lot younger than Bender, too. We'd be a dream team if you put him on the ice with me and Lincoln. Something to think about for later. Ah, Walker, the goalie with a face that could launch 1,000 ships, I drawled. He snorted and extended a hand like he was offering a VIP ticket to the I'm Gonna Steal Your Girl show. Nice to have you on board, he said, all charming and Disney Prince-ish. I shook it, fighting the urge to ask if he always had a wind machine following him around. I got dressed and followed him down a hallway to practice. Out on the ice, it was the first time I felt like maybe I hadn't landed on an alien planet. The cold bite of the rink, the familiar swoosh of skates. New team, but same ice. As I skated around, I could pretend for a second that I was home in Dallas, about to lay Lincoln on his ass. But then Soto skated by me, and I remembered how bad this place sucked. A whistle blew, and it was time for practice to begin. Cobra's head coach, Kim Palmer, introduced me like I was the star attraction at a circus. Ari Lancaster, a man who needs no introductions after the hell he's put his team through. He's God's gift to hockey, and we're lucky bastards to have him. Okay, maybe that's not exactly what he said, but close enough. Coach Kim himself looked like he just stepped out of a motivational poster. Salt and pepper hair, stern jawline, the kind of guy you'd expect to find delivering a halftime speech in a sports movie. He had that I've-seen-it-all aura, like he could predict our plays before we even made them. I half expected him to start quoting Sun Tzu's Art of War. He was a decent coach surrounded by mid-tier talent. Not much he could do about that. Drills were the name of the game as practice began. Skating, passing, shooting. We were like a discombobulated dance troupe, except with more helmets and fewer sequins. Soto, in his ever-enthusiastic state, decided it was a fantastic idea to try to check me, like we were in the NHL version of a WWE showdown. I laughed as I pried myself off the boards. Is that all you got, Bird Brain? Because your check was about as effective as your mama's mouth last night. Soto's face went a violent shade of red that almost matched his awful hair. Fuck you, he roared for the second time today, because his pea-sized brain obviously couldn't think of anything more creative than that. He moved to come after me again when Walker skated by, all diplomacy and dimples. Soto, wish you tried that hard to hit people in games. All right, this Walker guy wasn't too bad. Soto grimaced at Walker's comment, but surprisingly he didn't say anything else. He just skated off in a huff. I winked at Walker and he rolled his eyes. We got back to practice, the drills blending into each other like a workout montage. The ice echoed with the slap of pucks and the scrape of skates, a soundtrack of effort and anticipation. It felt all wrong. After all these years, I could read Lincoln and my other Dallas teammates easily, predict what they were going to do before they did it. The only thing I could predict with this team was that Soto would suck. At least I could take solace in why I was doing all of this, what the end game would be. When Walker asked if I wanted to hit happy hour afterwards, it was easy to say no, because today, my plan for that end game began.
Chapter 3. Blake. I'd found myself in the whirlwind of Los Angeles, a city where the glitzy guise of stardom hid the darker stories of shattered dreams. And I was on the verge of becoming one of those darker stories. That job that was supposed to be the game changer, the one that promised to kickstart my career, it had crumbled like a sandcastle before the waves. The magazine editor in charge of the huge photo shoot I was supposed to star in with Voyage Magazine had gotten embroiled in a sexual harassment scandal that had canceled the whole project. There was now an investigation going on that was in the headlines of
every news outlet as more and more Voyage staffers and models came forward with horror stories. Maybe I dodged a bullet, but I felt more like I'd become the epitome of a cautionary tale. Yet another girl relegated to waiting tables as I tried to make it big. But at least I could finally breathe. The restaurant I now worked at had a reputation. It was the kind of place where celebrities went, where you could see the A-listers sipping their fancy cocktails at one table while aspiring actors and models balanced trays at another. My agent had gotten me the job, said it would be good for me to be hobnobbing with the stars. Maybe it was, but mostly it felt like I'd volunteered for sexual harassment instead of being paid for it. There was a buzz against my thigh as a text came in, and I sighed, knowing exactly who it was. Clark. We were still together, or at least I guess we were. He'd been devastated about my rejection of his marriage proposal, and even more devastated when I told him I was moving. But he told me he'd do anything to make it work. That he loved me. That I was it for him. Much nicer things than the Shepfields had to say about me blowing up their carefully laid plans for me.
You ungrateful, selfish brat. We've done everything for you. Giving you everything. You are nothing but the daughter of a murderer. And I gave you my name. This is how you repay us. You're a disappointment. A nothing.
Daughter of a murderer. A disappointment. Nothing. The words were a constant chant in my head, lining up with all the other ones that I told myself on the daily. My phone buzzed again, and I peeked around to see if anyone was watching before I pulled it out of my pocket. Clark.
I love you. I miss you. You're all I think about.
He said all of it so easily, and I couldn't even say I love you in my head. Guilt flooded my insides, the taste of it thick on my tongue, making me sick.
Girl, your order's up!
My coworker Bailey hissed as she passed by, her warm brown eyes bug-eyed and slightly crazy-looking as she sliced them towards the back where Daphne, the executive chef, was glaring at me impatiently. I hurried to grab the waiting dishes, having to cover almost the whole distance of the restaurant to do so. The place had a sleek, modern aesthetic that had graced many an interior design magazine. Minimalistic yet sophisticated, with soft, dim lighting that cast a warm glow, bathing the space in an inviting ambience that drew you in. The walls were adorned with abstract paintings, the tables inlaid with polished marble, and the plush, low-back chairs all contributed to an atmosphere of understated luxury. A marble-top bar stretched along one side, serving artisanal cocktails that looked more like works of art than beverages. The open kitchen, framed by a massive glass pane, allowed patrons to catch a glimpse of the culinary maestros in action. It definitely wasn't a shithole. I grabbed the tray of dishes with names I could barely pronounce and navigated the maze of tables as I headed to my section, filled with faces that expected to be known. Hollywood was the exact opposite of New York, where the rich